Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, live music report, Apple and stats. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I am Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
Strung a bit of different intonation on that. It's getting difficult. I try to intonate differently every week and I'm running out of ways to do it.
I was told this week by somebody who really likes this podcast that it's a really good podcast.
Are they right? It is.
If you're willing to persevere with the first couple of episodes. So that's sort of it.
Well, maybe they just listened to the two bad ones.
What they meant was...
I don't think there are any bad ones.
There's a lot of information, I think, is what they meant. So you have to customize your brain to be able to deal...
Customize?
Is that what I said?
You customized that word.
You have to customize. No, hang on. No, I can't say it. You have to get your brain ready...
Like customize it.
To absorb all of the information that we include in every single edition of Setlist.
I think it's very easy to follow. But just getting back, have we discussed the CMU pop quiz on this show before?
The CMU.
That we thought was really easy and then no one could do because it was so very specific, every question about something that had happened in the news.
This is Andy Malt reminiscing about something we did in 2008. Maybe it was 2009. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
We did a pop quiz for music.
Why don't we do
people.
One of our special editions on the CMU pop quiz? That's a point in time worth remembering.
And it seemed like a good idea at the time.
It was a good idea. We eventually got it right so that people could do it.
Problem was, Andy used to spend about 7 days preparing the questions. It wasn't a very good use of your time. And it turned out that people weren't following the news that we were reporting in the CMU Daily quite as... carefully as we had hoped, I think was the learning curve of that. Anyway, this is not a pop quiz. There is no questions coming up, but lots of facts. So put your brain into the fact-absorbing gear.
Yes, because...
Customize it, is what I'm saying.
As ever, we are going to look back at some of the biggest and most interesting news stories in the music industry of the last week. A week when... the music industry did its last big push of campaigning before the final copyright directive vote in Europe.
Yeah, as we know, the week ahead, the big European story that everybody is focused on is the final vote in the European Parliament.
I don't think there's anything else.
That's pretty much it, isn't it? On the European Copyright Directive, which of course includes the safe harbour reforming Article 13 and some other stuff. Article 13 has been very controversial. YouTube continues to push to have it. Actually, I've stopped paying attention. I don't know whether they want it deleted or reformed or what. The tech lobby are pushing. All of their supporters are pushing. But the music industry is pushing back. I did a quick count before I came to do this recording of the podcast. I think the music industry has now put out 7,004 open letters about the copyright directive.
Everyone in the music industry has individually written one now.
There is a lot of open letters about this. In fact, one arrived literally as I was leaving the office to come here to record this podcast. Maybe we'll report on that in Monday's CMU Daily.
Yeah, maybe we won't.
Why not have a look? But I did think there was one thing that they put out in the last 7 days, I think, which I thought was actually particularly clever. It was quite sneaky. We like sneaky.
I know what you're going to say. Yeah, I liked it.
So I liked the idea that basically they were, and obviously they weren't expecting this to have a positive response, but they sent an open letter to the boss of YouTube, who is?
Susan Wojcicki.
I'm sure Jason will edit out the 90 seconds of silence there where Andy tried to remember the name of the boss of YouTube.
I remembered her name. I was more wondering if I was going to risk the pronunciation without looking it up. And I did.
Well
done. So it might well be wrong.
And open letter to the boss of YouTube in which the music industry, so this was done by the campaigning group GSAC, which represents all of the collecting societies of Europe, has put together a campaign. I can't quite remember what it's called. Creators of Europe.
There's so many campaigns now. Who can keep up?
Lots of songwriter organisations are part of that. Also Impala, that represents the independent music community, was also a signatory of this letter. And it was basically saying to YouTube, hey, YouTube, you know how you have been pushing out your messaging about why Article 13 is evil and is going to kill the internet through your app and through your special YouTube channel and through all of your YouTube communications? Why don't you put our side of the argument to your audience as well? Which you might think is a mad thing to suggest. And as I say, they clearly never expected YouTube to say, all right, then we'll pump a load of adverts putting the other side's argument out. But it was quite clever because companies like YouTube and the sort of the tech lobby and those people who are critical of copyright and would like copyright actually to be watered down rather than boosted up often say that they are proposing for copyright forms to either be halted or for copyright to actually be relaxed on free speech grounds. It's all about free speech. YouTube and Google's concern about things like Article 13, it's not that it might result in them having to pay a little bit more money into the music industry. It's not about that. They would happily hand over more money to the music industry. The concern is that it might have an impact on everybody's free speech. And YouTube and Google and all those tech companies, there's nothing they love more than standing up for free speech. That's why everyone in the tech sector is so obsessed by getting everybody to sign an NDA. You know, when you have a meeting at some of these companies' offices, when you walk in, as you're sort of, you know, telling the person, oh, I'm here to meet so-and-so, you have to put your name into like a little iPad on reception desk. And what you're doing when you do that is you're signing an NDA that says you won't tell anybody about anything that happened while you're in the building. That's how big a fan of free speech the tech sector is. And so it basically was the music industry being quite clever, I thought, in saying, aha, if this is all about free speech, YouTube, if you're such a big free speech organization, YouTube, then surely you would want your audience to hear both sides of the argument. Because if you're not allowing both sides of the argument to present their case, then that's not freedom of expression. That's not free speech. So I thought it was quite an amusingly sneaky remark. Okay, yeah, we're never going to get free advertising on YouTube, but I thought it was quite a clever little letter.
I thought it was good. I liked it. I thought it would have been a lot better about 3 months ago.
Yes, probably.
It felt quite a lot like, you know, when someone says something to you and 3 days later, you think of what the response should be. It felt a bit like that. I mean, it was almost like it just got in under the wire. But I mean, it almost feels like they almost thought of it after the vote. It's a bit too late to be doing that now.
You think there was a meeting 10 days ago where suddenly somebody said,
oh, you know what we should have done?
We should have done last November.
Like, oh, let's do it anyway.
But anyway, that was one of the, what did I say? Did I say 8,007?
I don't know what you said. I don't listen to you.
Of the many, 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 many open letters that have gone out about the whole copyright directive. So another one was added to the pile. Actually, several were added to the pile last week. That was the one that amused me and therefore interested me. So the final vote is incoming in the European Parliament on the copyright directive. I think the EU Council then has to do a final vote.
Although, there's probably more votes. There seems to be just an unusually large amount of votes in the undemocratic EU.
But I think it is kind of felt that the EU Council will pretty much rubber stamp it. And then
it was undemocratic in inverted commas. Just, oh, God, Brexit. Anyway.
Well, of course, that's the thing, isn't it? In the European Union, for it to become European law, both the Parliament and the EU Council have to pass it, and then it becomes law. And then each of the 28/27 member states will have to implement the reforms in that directive into local copyright rules. They miss that final wonderful stage that we have here in this democracy of the United Kingdom, Great Britain, and Northern Ireland, where every act of Parliament has to go to the Queen for her signature.
Yeah.
And in theory, she could say no. I mean, she never does and never would. But in theory, she should. Because in this democracy, ultimately, we are all subjects of our monarch.
Yeah.
So maybe we should be thinking about our own constitution.
We don't make up our own laws anyway. It doesn't matter. The Queen gets no say in anything because we don't have our own laws.
No, the EU do it all. We're not here to have a Brexit conversation.
No, I don't want another Brexit. Why have I started doing that?
There
Sorry.
Is no Brexit in this edition of
Settlers. I mean, it's not going to happen anyway, is it?
I don't know. I think no predictions in the Brexit domain should be made because who knows? But that's not what we're here to talk about. This podcast is all about Article 13, not Article 50. No more Europe until we get to the
middle. Yes, God, we're not here to talk about that.
Until we get to the middle story, and there was a little bit more Europe in that.
Yeah,
but not
is.
Brexit.
All right, we're not here to talk about that specific thing we just talked about. Instead, this week, we're going to talk about, well, as you said, Spotify's continued battle with Apple over its claims of anti-competitive behavior, and there's been some back and forth between both companies since we last spoke about it on the show last week. We're also going to be talking about the BPI's latest stats about growth in the UK music industry and why we should all be thoroughly depressed about all of it, because it's all very depressing, because you can never be happy in the UK record industry. It's not allowed.
And they managed to be depressed in their announcement of those stats that included the latest increase of revenues for the UK record industry, without even including Brexit in their list of gripes.
Yeah, but don't let's get onto that.
Well, they must have got the memo that we're not talking about Brexit, yes, on this week's set list, so that's why they didn't put it in there.
Let's not get into that now, because first we're going to talk about the live music industry in a very broad sense, because the UK Parliament's Digital Media, Culture and Sport Select Committee put out a big report on, well, just everything, really. Live music.
To do with live music. Not everything.
Not everything.
That would be a very wide report.
It was a live music report. It was all about live music, and it covered a lot of things, which is why you may have seen lots of stories in the news about live music, about different things in the live music. They all came from this same report.
Different people honed in on different things.
Yes, so, and there were a lot of different things to hone in on. We're going to do all of them because, you know, that's the sort of thing we do.
Too many facts, but persevere, it's worth it. I have that on good authority. So, yeah, this is the UK Parliament, not the European Parliament, those shysters over there. This is a proper British parliamentary report from the Select Committee for Digital. They changed their name a couple of years ago, didn't they?
I know. It's
they added digital.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to cover all things digital.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big remit when you think about it, isn't it? Digital.
Well, they do that, don't they, all the time. Like, we need to talk about digital things. Do you know what digital things are? No, just put digital in the title and it'd probably be fine.
Digital watches. Do you think they've ever done any reports on digital watches?
I'm not sure they know what they are yet.
That's what they should do. Digital, culture, media, sport. But this was live music.
Yeah.
Which I guess is culture.
Yeah, it's not sport.
It's not sport, and it's not really media. And, well, ticket touting is
digital.
Some
of it was digital.
So
two things.
A bit of digital and a bit of culture. So this was a report that this select committee started about a year ago. So the main job of the select committees is to scrutinise the work of government. So basically, for each department of government in the UK, there's a select committee in Parliament made up of MPs. MPs who are not also in government, because that would be cheating. And their job is to ask questions and to call ministers and civil servants from whichever department they are focusing on to make sure that everybody knows what's going on. But beyond that, they also then look at whichever part of society that department is focused on. And occasionally they will commission reports or they will stage open hearings and debates to consider issues around the sectors and the parts of society where their focus is. So in the case of the DC, hang on, which comes first? DMCS? DCMS?
DCMS.
So anything to do with digital, culture, media, sport, occasionally they'll commission these reports, have these debates, and then sometimes the output of that is a bunch of recommendations for government or maybe for parliament in terms of passing new law. Select committees have no power to force government to do stuff, but they can make recommendations. And then sometimes, actually, the output of those reports are more recommendations for a certain business, certain sector, certain companies. And with this massive, wide-ranging report on live music, there was a combination of both of those. Some of it was, OK, we've looked at this, here's our conclusions, and we think the government should do something about this. And then with others, it was like, OK, we've had a good think about this, and we think that actually the industry should do something about this. And I suppose across the report, it was very wide-ranging. I would say the big things they talked about, unsurprisingly given the focus, live music, was struggling venues and secondary ticketing, I guess were the big two. And then they also talked a little bit about education and the role of live music in educating musicians and providing musicians with a platform. And they also talked a little bit about issues around licensing of venues, which put on shows and particularly more sort of urban music shows, relating to some of the conversations we've had here in London around the old 696 form, but similar issues elsewhere in the world. So I guess those are the main four things, weren't
yes.
they? So what was that? Venues, secondary ticketing, licensing, education.
Yep.
Let's go through each in turn.
Okay. What do you want to do first?
I think we should do venues first.
Oh, okay. Well, that's been in the news, hasn't it? Certainly been in this podcast. There's been a lot of issues with small venues. We've discussed it a lot on the show over a number of years. There's been a lot of issues for small venues for a long time now. But the big thing at the moment, as we discussed last week, is business rates. There were changes to business rates and there have not been exemptions applied to small venues. And so small venues are struggling to survive with higher business rates because, hey, they're always struggling with something and you might as well lay something else on top of them.
Yeah, so the Select Committee's report kind of went through all of the various issues that small venues have been facing that we've discussed a lot here on Setlist and the organisations like the Music Venue Trust and UK Music have been campaigning on. But you're right, they did specifically hone in on the business rates issue. Of everything, it's the most timely. It's also the thing that UK Music and MVT have been specifically pushing on in the political environment in recent weeks/months. So business rates in the UK were reformed a couple of years ago. Some grassroots venues saw their bills go up quite significantly. As a result of that, the government then introduced a business rates relief scheme to help small businesses on the high street who were struggling. Shops were covered, bars were covered, restaurants were covered. but venues were not.
Yes, and the report warned that venues are closing down at an unprecedented rate and said that this had a real possibility of meaning that the next generation of Ed Sheerans and Adeles and popular musicians who bring in a lot of money for the UK economy, not having those sort of early small venues to hone their craft in and become the stars of tomorrow.
It also pointed out how this was something that was affecting small music venues in a way that it wasn't affecting venues in other cultural disciplines.
Yes.
So like theatre and film and dance and other forms of culture.
Yes. I mean, in fact, the report recommended applying tax relief that's already applied to orchestras to a wider range of music.
So they made a number of recommendations, but they did hone in on this business rates thing. We already knew that there was cross-party support in Parliament for adding music venues to this list of small businesses that benefit from this business rates relief. But as yet, the Treasury and the Chancellor of the Exchequer have not made that happen. And so this was yet more parliamentary pressure on government to try and get this sorted. And obviously, Music Venues Trust UK Music will be hoping that that again demonstrates that there is support across the political spectrum for music venues to be helped in at least this one way. And maybe the government can get on with that because they've got nothing else to be thinking about at the moment, as previously discussed.
Yes.
This is a Brexit-free...
Nothing else going on.
...podcast. Of course, the Music Venue Trust would point out that there are a number of other important issues too, some of which also require the government to intervene, but some of which actually require more industry stuff as well. So we have to be wary that if we do sort out this specific business rates relief scheme thing, massive tick on that, let's hope that does happen maybe in the next month. Does feel like momentum is moving in that direction. But that is just the first thing on quite a long list of things that need to be addressed by both government and the industry. And I'm sure the Music Venue Trust would like us to point that out. And of course, I suppose in some ways, licensing issues are on that list as well.
Yes.
Various licensing issues in the way that local authorities license venues for music. But the thing that the report specifically honed in on is another thing that we've reported on quite a lot over the years. About 10 years ago, this was a really big issue in London, and it sort of came back a couple of years ago, which is the perceived institutionalized racism in some licensing processes. The way venues are licensed varies quite a bit around the country. Local police forces will have an input on whether or not licenses are dished out. And again, policies vary around the country. But it is seen that some local authorities are biased against more urban music type events when they are issuing, or more importantly, not issuing licenses. Or, and it was interesting that they noted this, even if that's not the case, it is perceived that it is the case, which means that some venues, which are cautious about licensing things, might turn away events because they think, oh, that's going to go against us with the local authority, even if actually it wouldn't.
Yeah, so rapper Shaldo was one of the people who spoke to the committee about this particular issue. And he recalled one particular incident saying, I had a venue cancel me on the day I was meant to go there. I was booked for a performance in a club and called them ahead of time saying, I'm on my way. And they said, oh, by the way, we were just listening to your music. You make hip hop. And I said, yes. And he said, oh, we can't do that here. We'll lose our license. Which, I mean, that seems very unlikely. But that's leading into the extreme cautiousness of some venues. And with that in mind, the committee called for cross-departmental action by government to develop guidance for licensing authorities, police forces, and music venues on risk management to ensure that urban music acts are not unfairly targeted.
And a lot of the attention in the past on this story has focused on London, where the Metropolitan Police had their infamous Form 696 that applied to shows where recorded music was part of the performance, which was kind of code for hip-hop shows where you've got a DJ at the back of the stage. Yeah. And the original version of 696 was incredibly controversial because it was asking for things like the expected ethnicity of the target audience and the names and addresses of everyone taking part. So there was a big controversy around that, about 10 years ago. They then edited the form, so they got rid of the most controversial stuff, and then people kind of stopped talking about it. And then a couple of years ago, people started to say, okay, the form's not as bad as it used to be, but there are still issues with this. And obviously, this was following a period where grime had exploded. And so those genres were really important for the UK music scene and the London music scene. And eventually, the Metropolitan Police dropped Form 696, actually under pressure from both central government and from the London mayor. But it is felt that similar practices have been adopted elsewhere in the country. And maybe some of those practices are still skewing against urban music, or, as we said several times already, even where actually those policies have been removed, Maybe venues have not been made aware of that, hence why things are happening like what Shadow reported there. So that was another recommendation aimed at government in the report. On the education point, they did talk about the importance of venues as being a place where young artists can learn their craft and find an audience. And then there was some general stuff about music education, even though that's almost outside of the remit of this report and kind of moving it into a totally different conversation that is going on. There have been so many reports on music education elsewhere in recent months. We're planning on looking at all of them at The Great Escape in May. But the list of what we're going to be talking about keeps getting longer because people keep putting out more bloody reports on music education. But there was a little reference to that in this report. But probably the thing where this report was most outspoken, perhaps unsurprisingly, was on secondary ticketing.
Yes, our old friend, secondary ticketing. And this was the most fun bit of the report, I guess, because it's where they started laying into Viagogo, which, I mean... Are we at the point yet where we feel a bit sorry for Viagogo?
No.
No, okay. these things come in waves, don't they? So, okay, we're still down on Viagogo. I mean, it's probably rightly, aren't we? Certainly when the government is warning people not to use a company to buy tickets, I mean, it's going to the top now. It's not just the music industry saying, we don't like this company now. It's Parliament saying, we really don't think you should use this company at all because... they're a bit shoddy.
Of course, a lot has happened in the second ticketing debate in the year that this report was in development, which we've talked about a lot on Setlist, not least on our entire special edition.
Yeah, there was that, wasn't there?
Just on this story. And of course, Viagogo has now twice declined to attend sessions organised by this select committee.
Yeah, so that probably doesn't help.
The Culture Select Committee, where they were asked to come and answer questions about secondary ticketing, and twice... they were no-shows, and the second time, like a real last-minute no-show.
Yeah, the second time they said they were going to come.
An incredibly lame excuse. Did they not blame Ed Sheeran in the end?
Yeah, probably.
They blamed Ed Sheeran for not showing up. So, unsurprising that this select committee has no time for Viagogo. They noted that the Competition and Markets Authority here in the UK got a court order late last year ordering Viagogo to comply with UK consumer rights law. Of course, we've talked about on Setlist in recent weeks how the CMA has concluded that Viagogo is yet to do that. And they are now going back to court to ask the judge to hold Viagogo in contempt of court for not following that injunction. So the report acknowledged all of this. It said the CMA is right to do this. We urge the CMA to get on with this as fast as possible without delay. But in the meantime, while all of that is going on, we do fear that... people will still be buying tickets on this website. They'll still be going there via Google searches. They did a little bit of Google dissing as well, didn't they? Because, of course,
got to get that in.
Google changed their rules last year, putting some obligations on secondary ticketing sites that advertise through Google search. And Select Committee said those rules were great, but you don't really seem to be enforcing them. It would be good if you could enforce those rules. But they were basically saying, because Google aren't enforcing their rules and the CMA action is going to take a little bit longer, people may still be getting onto the Viagogo site, possibly not even realising that it's a secondary site and buying tickets. And so they basically said, we tell the citizens of this United Kingdom, do not buy or sell tickets on Viagogo, was what they said.
Yes, and Viagogo said it was disappointed with the report. It said, we came to our agreement with the CMA, which is the agreement is what it's consistently called, its court order, which that's not the same as an agreement, whatever. And it said, we complied with that. And we continue to work with the CMA to make tweaks here and there where it still thinks things aren't quite right. We're totally on board with this. I don't know why everyone's getting on our back about it all the time. The CMA, I think, would say something very different about how they're working together, which is why it's now going back to court to try to get another ruling against it. I mean, a ruling that I don't think it will, but a ruling that potentially could lead to jail time to Viagogo execs. Which, when something gets to that, that doesn't suggest that we're just working together and tweaking things.
I thought it was also interesting that Viagogo said that the incredibly small number of people who have problems with tickets they buy in Viagogo, this is Viagogo's words, are generally the result of promoters cancelling touted tickets, which we've talked about a lot on Setlist, because under the terms and conditions of most tickets sold in the UK, they're not allowed for resale. So if they are resold, and if the promoter can just work out which tickets have been touted, then the promoter is within their rights to cancel them.
Mm.
And the Consumer Rights Act is quite explicit that providing, that is important that it is in the terms of the original ticket, but providing the original terms say that resale is not allowed and resold tickets will be cancelled, promoters can do that. And Viagogo frequently in their statements say the opposite. And they say, oh, the illegal cancelling of tickets. And I thought this time they were slightly more cautious in that statement. They said the overwhelming majority of cases where tickets don't get people into the show are due to the unfair and potentially illegal. So potentially illegal if Parliament rewrites the Consumer Rights Act. So in that respect, they're right. If you insert that extra little bit in the middle.
I mean, Viagogo's position, as you say, for some time now has been that it believes that cancelling tickets is illegal. But I mean, normally when companies think that other companies are doing something illegal, they challenge it in the legal system. But that is not something that Viagogo has as yet done.
But quite a few tweets and emails to CMU.
Tweets are the same as legal action anyway.
Maybe they think sending us an email is the same as going to court. Maybe they got confused.
It's possible.
CMU, CMA, you know, we're kind of...
is that what
maybe that's what they think when they're emailing us, saying this is illegal. They think that we're some sort of authority that can force that to happen. But yeah, bold statements in that report against Viagogo. Not surprising. And not surprising that Viagogo was annoyed with it, really. But interesting slash amusing nonetheless.
Yes, and I think that's my favourite combination of things. Interesting and amusing. I'll take that. Obviously, there's recommendations made in that report, so there'll be lots of things to watch and see what changes, what doesn't. I mean, obviously, in the past, there have been issues with the Select Committee that they've made recommendations about things, and then there's been a change of government, and that's reset everything, and they've kind of had to start again. And who knows what's going to happen? I know we're not talking about the thing, but the thing might make that sort of thing happen again in the very near future. So who knows? We might yet have another report where all this stuff gets talked about yet again.
Governments are very good at ignoring Select Committee recommendations, but you have to have a government to ignore them. And by the time this podcast goes out, we might not even have one. So we will see.
Still to come on this episode of Setlist, some stats, and who doesn't like stats? I know we said we weren't going to do a quiz, but let's have a little quiz. Have a little think now. What earns more money for the UK record industry, vinyl or YouTube? Answer in like 10 minutes, maybe. But now we're going to talk about Spotify and Apple again, because that is all still happening. And, well, I just said I like things that are interesting and amusing. This is both of those things.
So this relates to the thing we talked about at length on last week's set list. And there are two, in theory, separate stories, but which keep sort of bumping together. So there is the whole dispute between Spotify and the music publishers and songwriters of America over the Copyright Royalty Board's ruling that the revenue share allocated to the song copyright by streaming services in the US should rise over the next few years from the old rate of just over 10% to a new rate of just over 15%. And Spotify is appealing the Copyright Royalty Board ruling on that rate decision, insisting that it's not against the increase in principle, but it has some issues with the specifics of the compulsory license that covers the mechanical copying of songs in the US. So that was a story we talked about quite a lot last week. That is ongoing. Spotify is trying to defend its position. Apparently, they're organising face-to-face meetings with songwriters in America. I suspect those won't go well.
No. Well, there's the whole thing now of people are saying, well, I mean, this is being led by the National Music Publishers Association, the NMPA, but there is now a whole group of people saying to songwriters, you should not attend these meetings unless someone who can give the other side of the argument is there. When they say someone, they mean David Israelite from the NMPA. I mean, that would be fun. I suspect if Spotify is organising those meetings, they're not going to be keen to put him on with them, but it would be a lot of fun. I'd go to those meetings. I would fly to the US to be at one of those meetings.
You really wouldn't?
No, I wouldn't. But I would say it flippantly as if I would.
So that whole thing's ongoing. But really, we're here today to talk about the beef between Spotify and Apple. So we also mentioned this last week, because this story had already begun before last week's set list.
But we've had more statements since then.
More statements on both sides. So Spotify has gone to the European Commission in the good old European Union to have a good moan about Apple, which it says behaves in an anti-competitive way in order to give Apple Music an unfair advantage in the digital music market by things like the Apple tax, which we talked about on last week's set list, and indeed we've talked about before. None of these complaints coming from Spotify are new. Spotify and a number of other digital music players in Europe and in the US have moaned about these things over the years. The Apple tax being the fact that when you take a transaction through an Apple iOS app, Apple take a 30% cut of the money. So if Spotify was to sign up a user, a premium user, through its iOS app and charge to £10 a month, Apple would want 30% of that money every month. 30% is Spotify's profit margin, its best case scenario profit margin. So clearly that doesn't work for Spotify or indeed any of Spotify's competitors except Apple Music. So that's been a gripe of the streaming music companies for a while. But the big development earlier this month was that Spotify actually put a formal complaint in to the European Commission. Daniel Ek, founder and boss of Spotify, wrote quite a lengthy blog post outlining the concerns.
There's also a whole microsite with lots of different articles and bits of information on why Apple is the root of all evil.
Yeah, they got lots of videos made to explain their side of the argument. So all of that had happened just before we recorded the last edition of Setlist. Almost immediately, Apple put out an even longer statement in response, although they didn't have a microsite ready to go, but quite a long statement in response. And there was two sides to that. First of all, they started picking holes in Spotify's complaint and all of the things that Spotify had said about the way Apple works. And they were basically saying Spotify wouldn't be the success story it was if it wasn't for having an app on the iPhone. And to have apps on the iPhone, that requires all of the huge amount of money that Apple has spent in developing the operating system, the App Store, the payment system. And Spotify benefits from all of that, and it just doesn't want to pay its share for accessing that.
Yeah, basically saying that Spotify wants all of the benefits of the App Store without having to pay for it. A bit like Brexit,
yeah, a bit like
which we're not talking about.
The UK wants from the EU.
So, it was, yeah, saying that, look, this costs us money. We have to take some money to pay for it. And Spotify gets a really good deal out of it. They also said that, you know, Spotify, they were talking about the 30%. They don't mention that actually that drops to 15% after a year. So it's not taking 30% a month for the rest of time.
Although it's still taking 15%.
15% is still a sizable chunk. But it's basically said that Spotify misrepresented what Apple offers and takes.
It also said that Spotify was looking for special treatment because all apps are treated the same on the App Store. Although that kind of ignored two things. First of all, but Apple Music isn't being treated the same. Well, it probably is, but it doesn't matter to Apple Music if Apple's taking 30%. Yeah. I didn't talk about that at all, didn't even mention it. And then it did concede that although it was saying all app developers, when they're taking money off an app, have to pay this 30%, it did then say, oh, but only for digital content. So Uber doesn't have to pay it, for example. So if you're getting a physical service or physical product, or like Deliveroo doesn't have to pay it. So it's basically saying everyone has to pay this 30%. Don't know what Spotify's talking about. Oh, except for pretty much every kind of app, except digital content, of which there's a relatively small number. So I'm not sure their arguments were perfect. They also then talked about Spotify had said that they felt Apple was trying to block them out of certain Apple devices. And they hit back and said, we're not doing that. Actually, it's Spotify's fault. We keep going to Spotify and say, yeah, let's get your services integrated with all our super new gadgets. And Spotify are procrastinating on that. So they were really picking holes in all of Spotify's arguments. But that was not the amusing bit. The amusing bit came at the end. Well, actually, they alluded to it at the start as well of this very long statement. But the last bit of the statement was where they glued those two stories together. Spotify versus Apple and Spotify versus the songwriters and publishers of America. By basically saying the issue here is that Spotify wants to have all the glory and it doesn't want to pay its fair share, doesn't want to contribute towards keeping the Apple ecosystem going, even though it's a huge beneficiary of the Apple ecosystem. And you know who else Spotify is trying to shortchange? You know who else Spotify doesn't want to pay their fair share to?
Well, in Apple's words, it's also artists, musicians, and songwriters. And of course, that's a position that Apple is free to take because it, as we discussed last week, is not joining that appeal against the mechanical royalties ruling. So it can saunter around saying, well, we're friends of artists, musicians and songwriters.
But Spotify is not. Yeah, because it's not just Spotify who is appealing the CRB royalty rate ruling. So are Amazon, so are Pandora, so are Google. But it is Spotify who are getting all of the heat. And the NMPA kind of suggested that it was Spotify and Amazon who decided they were going to appeal. And then everyone else felt that they had to appeal as well. Except Apple. which allowed Apple to say in its angry statement against Spotify's competition law complaints, just this week, Spotify sued music creators. This is a line that keeps going around, that Spotify is suing songwriters, which it isn't.
It's not what happened.
It's going through an entirely legitimate appeal process on the compulsory license in the US. Although that line, Spotify is suing songwriters, began with the National Music Publishers Association. That was a line that they used, and lots of other people picked up online, including Apple. Spotify sued music creators after a decision by the US Copyright Royalty Board required Spotify to increase its royalty payments. This isn't just wrong, says Apple. It represents a real, meaningful, and damaging step backwards for the music industry, is what Apple reckons. Whereas...
Apple's approach has always been to grow the pie. Is that true?
Which pie?
Well, it doesn't say, it just says pie. It might be just a pie. Can you grow a pie?
I don't think you can.
I don't know anything. Once you've cooked a pie, that's it.
Do pies expand in...
You could build another pie around it.
In the oven? Does the pastry kind of expand? Puff pastry,
no,
would,
you're thinking
it?
Of cakes.
I'm thinking of cakes. Puff pastry expands in the oven, doesn't it?
I suppose.
So they probably are expanding...
I should say they want to grow the cake. I'm not sure this is the point they were making.
No.
No, they were saying Apple's approach has always been to grow the pie. By creating new marketplaces, we can create more opportunities, not just for our business, but for artists, creators, entrepreneurs, and every crazy one with a big idea. I wouldn't put crazy one in there. I'm not sure. Anyway, that's in our DNA. I wouldn't put that in either. It's the right model to grow the next big app ideas. And ultimately, it's better for customers.
Definitely better for those customers.
Good old customers.
So that was Apple's response to Spotify's complaint in the European Commission about their allegedly anti-competitive conduct. And then getting in, I would say a sneaky little, but it was several paragraphs.
Well, like you say, it was long.
Of dissing, well, no, but specifically dissing Spotify about what's happening in America.
Oh, yeah.
Of
okay.
Joining those two different stories together. Spotify did then respond to the response.
Yes, it's not over. Don't think we've finished.
So Spotify put out a, albeit slightly shorter statement, in which basically they said, yeah, well, they would say that, wouldn't they?
Yes.
It's pretty much the conclusion.
Yeah, it said every monopolist will suggest that they have done nothing wrong and will argue that they have the best interests of competitors and consumers at heart. In that way, Apple's response to our complaint before the European Commission is not new and is entirely in line with our expectations.
We filed our complaint, Spotify went on, because Apple's actions hurt competition and consumers and are in clear violation of the law. Don't know if that's true. Which law, I guess, would be the question to ask there. This is evident in Apple's belief. This is referring to some things that Apple said in their statement. This is evident in Apple's belief that Spotify users on iOS are Apple's customers, and they're not. They are Spotify's customers. Which goes to the very heart of the issue with Apple. We respect the process the European Commission must now undertake to conduct its review, was the conclusion of Spotify's response to Apple's response to Spotify's complaint with the European Commission about Apple's allegedly uncompetitive conduct in Europe.
TLDR, Apple doesn't want the EU to look into this, and Spotify does.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Spotify is still having a big bust-up with the songwriters and music publishers in America over the rise of the allocation of money to songwriters and publishers out of the streaming pie. Someone pointed out to me a few weeks ago, because we talk about digital pie a lot.
We do.
When we were being confused by what they meant by the pie, that was us being unfair.
Because we talk about the pie all the time. We know exactly what pie they mean.
The digital pie we talk about a lot. And someone pointed out...
We talk about growing the pie as well.
We do. They've got that out of CMU, I'm sure. All dissecting the digital dollar. Anyway, someone pointed out to me the other day that when I do my presentations about the digital pie, which I've done a lot...
You should have called it a cake.
Well, what he pointed out is that the diagrams I've created are not pie charts. They are basically bar charts. So a big long bar broken down up into how the money gets split up between the artists, the writers, the publishers, the services, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, well, you don't get oblong pies.
Could be a cross-section of a pie.
I suggested it was a strudel. In fact...
That's not a pie.
I'm thinking of changing it to the digital strudel because I like my slides. I think they look good. I don't want to have to create pie charts.
It could be a cross-section. You could definitely put a pie shape around that and it could be the pie filling.
Oh, you think if you slice the middle of the pie, is that what you're saying?
You could make that work.
All right, then. I quite like the idea.
I'm not sure the type of baked good is the most important thing.
I quite like the idea of starting to talk about the digital strudel. I prefer strudels to pies. So maybe I'll email Apple and ask them in the next...
Apples in strudels.
Well, there is. It could be an Apple strudel. There you go. This is all working fine. I'm going to email...
There's no Spotify in strudels.
I'm going to email my Uncle Tim.
Do you have an Uncle Tim?
He doesn't have E on his cook. I'm going to email Tim...
Oh, that right, him.
...to tell him that in all future statements they should refer to growing the digital open brackets Apple close brackets strudel. I'm not quite sure how we got onto this.
I think we should just wrap this up.
Let's wrap this up and do some plugging.
Well, I think you just killed the suspense, but now it's time to do some plugging. I assume you've got something to plug. You've always got something, haven't you?
Somehow, we've got to the end of March 2019 on set list. We had a lot of special editions at the start of the year, didn't we?
Yeah.
Because you kept going off places.
What?
Oh, no, that was me.
Yeah.
We've got this far into
the year. I've gone nowhere.
Without me spending a few minutes of set list to talk about The Great Escape.
Okay, well, I mean, we shouldn't break that trend. Let's move on. And finally this...
Well, no, it's getting very close. Getting very close. If we don't talk about The Great Escape now, then it might be that we have another couple more special editions and it'll all be over. And I've not even told people that The Great Escape returns in May.
I'm sure everyone listening is already coming.
The Showcase Festival in Brighton, which takes place over 3 days in Brighton. And as part of that, we have The Great Escape Conference, which actually takes place over 4 days in Brighton.
Yeah.
Because the conference kicks off on the Wednesday morning, and the festival then follows on the Thursday morning. And once again, CMU is presenting three, count them.
One.
Two.
Two. Hang on, let me do it. One. Two. Three.
Three.
Is it when?
Conferences.
There's three. I'm just checking. Yeah. Sorry, carry on.
It's a good job.
There's nothing on the Saturday.
It's a good job. Well, there is. I was trying to get to that.
Oh, four.
But you...
Four?
Well, no. You see, now, this has taken such a long time now, you've forgotten what the opening of this sentence was.
I have, yeah.
Because the opening of the sentence was that we present three conference strands.
Yep.
Wasn't talking about days.
Count them again?
No. Do not want you to count them again. There are three CMU conference strands on the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday of The Great Escape.
Uh-huh.
And then more stuff. On Saturday, the educational program stuff is happening on the Saturday. So let me talk you through this. On the Wednesday, which is, if you're keeping count, the 8th of May, we have our music education conference. So whereas on the Saturday, there's a whole load of educational content for people at the start of their music business careers.
Yep.
On the Wednesday...
It's stuff for people at the end of their careers.
It's about music education.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier that there have been... Not quite 8,007, but not far off, reports published in the last 6 months about the state of music education in the UK, some of which say it's all fucked up, and some of which say, actually, it's not, we're just looking in the wrong places. That's another TLDR I'm doing there for you.
It's not really TLDR, is it? Because it's audio. People don't say TLDL.
Do all right, it'll be a
more pleasing, a TLDL.
But anyway... We're going to be looking at all of those reports on music education that have come out in recent months. But more than that, we've been doing our own work. So we're presenting the initial findings of the Redefining Music Education project that CMU launched at last year's Great Escape. So we'll be looking at what is music education in the UK.
What is it?
What should there be in the curriculum? Where should it be happening in the classroom, outside the classroom? Should there be more entrepreneurial practical skills thrown in there as well? How can the music industry... and music education collaborate, and we'll be looking at a number of projects where actually that's already happening, but how those could be escalated. Plus, we'll have a very special guest doing an in-conversation at the end of the day, which we haven't announced yet, but we will do
keep quiet
very soon. So that's the music education focus on Wednesday, the 8th of May. Then on Thursday, the 9th of May, for the first time ever, actually, I'm not quite sure why it's taken us this long, we've got a whole day looking at the Dissecting the Digital Dollar work that we've been doing over the last 5 years. We have had various bits and pieces within our conference over the years, which pull out of the Dissecting Digital Dollar Project and book. But we've got a whole day looking at all of the issues that the Digital Dollar Project has raised over recent years, obviously that being our work with the UK Music Managers Forum, and we'll have various people from the MMF and from the MMF board contributing as part of this day. So basically, across about 5 hours, we will explain how the streaming business works, how it works on the recording side. We'll have a look at how services are starting to become distributors.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, distributors are starting to become record labels.
Yep.
So what are record labels going to do? Will be one of the debates that we'll be having. We will have some brand new digital dollar research looking at how songwriters are paid by streaming services, or not, as the case may be.
Yeah.
So you know how all of that value gap, safe harbor, YouTube in Europe.
Yep.
Let's assume the copyright directive goes through. Things get reformed and YouTube starts putting more money in.
And it gets implemented over here.
And it all gets sorted.
Despite the thing we're not talking about.
And let's assume in America that the 15%, the increase of what's being allocated to the song, that still goes through despite all of Spotify's shenanigans. The songwriter rate still goes up. There's a very high chance that actually many songwriters will see zero benefit from that.
Hey!
For all sorts of technical reasons, which I will explain at the Digital Dollars Day at The Great Escape, and we'll have some experts there to explain what the issues are and to discuss possible solutions. We'll also look at data. You know how 3 years ago, every single music conference in the world, including ours.
Yep. I thought you were going to gloss over that, but yeah.
Had a session on music data.
Mm.
And then some people stood up and said, we think the blockchain is the solution.
Yeah, I remember that.
To the music industry's data problem. And then everybody went on a massive 12-month tangent of, what's the blockchain? Oh, the blockchain's this thing that powers cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. It's like, well, what's Bitcoin? Oh, it's cryptocurrency. Let me explain to you cryptocurrencies. And then we went on a massive one-year explanation of what cryptocurrencies were. At the end of which it was like, oh, but none of that's relevant to the music industry. It's just a way of distributing data over multiple machines. Blah, blah, blah. Well, what I want to know is, in the 3 years since we had all those conversations, has anything actually happened? Because
Let's hope so.
because bad music rights data is stopping artists from getting paid. And it's certainly stopping songwriters from getting paid. Some things have happened. So we'll have a look at what all of that is. So that is the Thursday of The Great Escape. Friday, our focus is music marketing. So we'll be looking at all the different aspects of music marketing in 2019. We'll even dedicate a little bit of time to influencer marketing.
Ooh.
Because I have officially conceded that I now have to refer to influencers as influencers, even though I hate that term.
Mm.
But we will have a look at things like influencer marketing. We'll have a look at all the data sides to doing a music marketing campaign. But most importantly of all, we'll be looking at how music marketing campaigns are changing, because in the streaming age, you can't do a 12-week campaign anymore. You need to do a 6-month campaign, a 12-month campaign. What does that mean? Probably means that labels and managers and promoters and artists have got to collaborate more. What does that mean? All of these things will be discussed over our music marketing strand, which will then conclude at the end with an in-conversation with Cassandra Gracie, who runs Fourth Floor Creative Division at Sony Music. So those are the core strands that are happening at the Great Escape Conference this year. There'll also be the partner panels going on in addition to all of that, and the parties. AIM are also presenting their AIM house next door at the Queen's Hotel. I say next door because this year, the main conference activity, all of our activities happening in the Juries Inn Waterfront in Brighton. That's new.
Mm.
Very exciting. And then the AIM house activity will be right next door. And then on the Saturday, we will be presenting a bunch of seminars for people at the start of their music careers. There'll be a whole load of DIY panels as well. More on that to come very soon. I haven't even got in to the TGE Elevate program that we announced this week. Not time to talk about that here.
No, check I'm still out. Annoyed about the name of it. Thought my suggestions were better.
We brainstormed what we should call this brand new professional development program at The Great Escape. And the TGE team came up with some. And I went to the CMU team, and the CMU team gave me some. And there were some great suggestions in there. Then I asked Andy.
Were there? I don't remember there being.
Yeah, there were. They're just not on your list.
Oh, right. I can't believe
everyone else's lists were great.
I can't believe It's Not Brighton was a brilliant name.
It was your suggestions that were shit. So we ignored those. And we went with TGE Elevate. And check out all the information on the CMU and Great Escape website about that. Hey. See you at The Great Escape. Get your delegates pass. Get you into all of that.
We'll almost certainly put a link to the way you can buy delegate passes in the show notes for this episode, which you'll find if you go to setlistpodcast.com. And finally this week, stats. Who doesn't love stats? Everyone loves stats because stats are quick to say and they sound good or bad. Either way, doesn't matter. But these ones are good. The UK recorded music industry's revenues were up 3.1% last year. That is, well, I just said it's 3.1%.
Up on 2017.
Wow, yeah.
So these are 2018 figures. The growth is slowing, it should be said. If you want to be pessimistic, it's up, that's great.
Which I sure do.
But the growth is not quite as fast. Streaming is still booming, which is driving that increase. But then we had a bit of a drop of physical. Well, we've been having a drop on physical for 15 years now. But the drop was slightly more last year than the previous year, which is why the overall increase was only 3.1%. You said this is recorded music. We should stress that, because lots of people report this as music industry, but this is recorded music, so not what comes through.
Actually, there's bits missing from recorded music.
PPL money's not in there. Don't know why. So anything that comes through the collective licensing system isn't included in these figures. And of course, it's not about songs. It's not about live. It is recorded music. So the main recorded music revenue streams that come in through the record companies. So the overall sum of money was up 3.1%. We knew that already.
It was up too. Should we say? Because I mean, 3.1, I mean, that could be, it was up from £3. It's more than £3, let me tell you that. It was £865.5 million. Imagine having that in your bank account.
So this is
what the record industry does. Well, it's got more than one bank account, but,
and it's probably,
you know,
spent most of it already.
Metaphorically.
So this is trade income. We already knew that £1.3 billion had passed through the tills of record shops and mail order sites and streaming services, because the Entertainment Retail Association get their figures out quicker. But this is the money that actually gets to the record companies once the retailers and all of them people have taken their cuts. So that's the figure we're talking about here. It is up 3.1%, mainly because of the old streaming boom.
Mm-hmm.
The streaming boom is still booming. It was, let's have a look at this. In 2018, premium subscriptions, because that's where streaming really makes its money, were up 34.9% in 2018 compared to 2017. Which means that those subscriptions alone, forget free Spotify, because you should, because we make about 20 pence out of that. But premium subscriptions from Spotify, Apple, etc. are now 54% of UK recorded music income. So that's not digital. It's not even streaming. It is premium streaming alone. It's 54% of UK recorded music revenues, providing we don't put PPL into the mix.
So that's, I mean, that's a lot, isn't it?
It is.
That's more than half. I don't know. Fans of numbers might have noticed that that is more than half.
So therefore, £467.6 million is how much is coming in from premium subscriptions. Now, we're kind of running out of time because you talked way too long about... what did you talk way too long about? I don't know. Maybe I talked way
too long. Well, there was that report and it was very long.
Maybe we should have, like every other media, picked one thing rather than talking about everything. Maybe I talked about The Great Escape for too long. But we're kind of running out of time, so let's just hone in on, say, maybe two more of the stats. But you did tease one, so we ought to answer that pop quiz question that you posed earlier.
Yes, so, which brings in more money, vinyl or YouTube? Well, it's vinyl, isn't it? Because, I mean, the vinyl revival is through the roof. Surely the vinyl makes up about 78% of all music industry income now, I think. Not just recorded music, just music industry. All of it. Just vinyl's... all of it.
I'm assuming you're sensing the sarcasm in Andy's voice there, because of course that's not true. Vinyl is still a niche product. They even admitted that in the BPI press release.
Yeah.
That vinyl is still a niche product. Because actually it's interesting, isn't it? Because normally it's, oh, vinyl's up. Yeah.
It makes up 3% of everything.
Whereas now, it's more than that now.
It is more than that now, all right.
What they were trying to say here is that vinyl brings in nearly double YouTube-type services. So it's not just YouTube, although...
I mean, it is.
Whatever YouTube-type services are there. And then they were saying, and not only that, vinyl is still quite a niche product.
Yes.
To try and make that.
And YouTube, you probably heard of YouTube, it's not really a niche product.
No, billions and billions and billions of streams, 30 billion, they reckon, of music videos. And yet they only brought in 29.7 million, which is not quite half, but not far off half of what vinyl brings in. I mean, I suppose, footnote to that, this is revenue, not profit. And putting your music up on YouTube, pressing and selling vinyl.
Yes.
I mean, when we come to profit margin, vinyl is not as lucrative as it may seem top level. But nevertheless, that was a stat. Physical was down across the board. Downloads continue to slump. But maybe as our final stat, we could talk about that other thing that often gets exaggerated in terms of how big a deal it is for the record industry.
Sync. Now, I mean, I was joking about vinyl making up 78% of all music industry income. But I mean, I've been to a lot of music conferences and I've seen a lot of panels on this. So I know that Sync, I mean, is responsible for most music industry income now across the board, as far as I know.
Yeah, every music conference. Actually, not ours.
No.
This is where we can actually say not ours. Most music conferences have panels with...
That's why I get to be flippant about it.
Music supervisors, the people who choose the music for movies and games, etc., working on the synchronization of music into video. And those panels always heavily... I mean, they wouldn't be quite as outright as you've just said, but they heavily imply...
They wouldn't be able to because it's not true.
...that sync is a much, much bigger deal than it really is. Because although sync revenues were up last year in the UK, it still accounts for 2.9% of the recorded music market. That doesn't include TV, because TV sync would go through PPL, and as already discussed, PPL figures aren't in here.
For some reason.
But it is what's coming in from movies and games and adverts. So less than 3%. I mean, to be fair, A, this is recorded music. If we were talking about published music, so songs, songwriters and publishers, sync's a much bigger deal for the publishing side of the business.
Yes.
Particularly if you throw library music and original commissions into the mix. So this is recorded music. And also, within that just under 3%, there are individual sync deals worth £1 million.
Yeah.
So for certain individual artists and certain labels, sync is an incredibly important part of the business. But across the board, it ain't. And there are lots of artists out there who, beyond getting some TV sync through PPL, may never see sync income across their entire career. So there you go. Some interesting stats released by the UK Regulatory Trade Body. All the trade bodies of all the record industries around the world are busy getting their stats out at the moment because the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, the IFPI, does its big report where it collates them all into one place, and that comes out at the very start of April. So everyone needs to get their stats out on a national level before the global figures come out. So that means we'll be talking about these stats again in a few weeks' time.
Unless we decide not to, but I mean, we probably will.
The global stats usually have something interesting in there. I'm expecting quite a leap from China in that report. Also Latin America, lots of focus on that. So we'll guarantee you that when we spend 10 minutes of Setlist talking about the RPR figures, we will not mention the UK, because we've done the UK.
Yep, that's all covered.
UK
except PPL income.
Is out of it. Except PPL income, where we'll spend 20 minutes discussing PPL income as part of our IFPI report, because that will include public performance and broadcast money in those figures. So yeah, I think that's enough stats to be getting on with.
Yeah, it probably is. And also, we have run out of time because I need to go home.
I think we ran out of time about 20 minutes ago. Yeah. Don't know how long this podcast is going to be in the final edit, but we will see.
We'll see. We were just making it longer now by carrying on talking. We should probably just wrap it up.
We'll wrap it up.
All right, then. That is the end of this episode of Setlist. Please do subscribe if you're not already. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. You know, begrudgingly, I guess. I have to let him in. It's produced by Matt Peaty. It's edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.